Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're going to be exploring a fascinating story about a fascinating woman. Her name, Aileen Griffith. She was someone who was a spy on behalf of the United States. And as you might guess, because of the nature of the work that spies do, it is often hard to know the exact truth of who they were and exactly what they do. And that is certainly the case with Aileen Griffith, who was a beautiful and charismatic woman who moved in some very, very dangerous circles, actually, in the last couple of years of the Second World War. And she is someone who actually had a remarkable life even beyond the work she did as a spy. And she's also someone who went on to do a fair amount of writing about her work as a spy. And some of that, in fact, most of that writing that she did sort of blends fact and fiction just a little bit, which, of course, makes it even more challenging to determine just exactly what her story was. That was the challenge undertaken by best-selling author Larry Loftus, who has written about spies before. His previous nonfiction spy thrillers include Codename Lisa, the true story of the woman who became World War II's most highly decorated spy, and Into the Lion's Mouth, the true story of Dusko Popov, World War II spy, patriot, and the real-life inspiration for James Bond. Mr. Loftus's latest book is titled The Princess Spy, the true story of World War II spy Aileen Griffith, Countess of Romanos, which is published by Atria Books. And I'm very grateful to Larry Loftus for making time in his schedule to have this conversation with me on the morning show. Larry Loftus, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. One thing I think would be interesting for us to touch on, at least briefly, is the fact that before you began devoting yourself exclusively to writing, you were a corporate attorney and a professor of law. Can you draw any sort of line of connection between that earlier chapter in your book and the work that you have done as a best-selling author, writing so extensively about the life and work of spies?
You mean the connection between my background as a lawyer and what I do as a writer?
Yes, exactly.
Right. It actually blends quite nicely, because if you're writing nonfiction, particularly scholarly nonfiction, you have to sift facts. You have to sift evidence. Oftentimes, things are contradictory. One person says this, one person says that. Sometimes the actual same person says different things because they get it. They make an error. They get it wrong. Sometimes it's intentional. Sometimes typically it's not. But So my job is to find out what really happened, you know, the truth. And that's where my legal background comes in, because I was trained as a lawyer. Lawyers sift evidence for a living. And there are certain hierarchical rules for valuing evidence and giving certain evidence more credibility and some less. For example, like conflicts of interest, that would diminish your credibility. If something is a formal document recorded by an agency at the time of the event, that's highly credible, like a spy report, you know, like an OSS report that Aileen filed, or an MI6 file report that Popoff filed. That's the highest level from the actual archive. So my training as a lawyer, and going all the way back to the years when I was on Law Review as an editor, and you're dealing with citations, and every line has to be cited, every fact has to be cited. And people ask me sometimes, this reads like a novel. Did you make some of this dialogue up? And the answer is, of course not. Then it would be historical fiction. It's all nonfiction. Every quote is verbatim from a primary source. And you can go to the back and look at the end notes and see exactly where that citation, that reference, that quote came from, and check it for yourself.
So how did you end up making the leap from being a practicing corporate attorney to becoming a full-time writer? First of all, was writing always something that you enjoyed doing? And at what point did something sort of galvanize you to kind of shift your professional sights?
It's always been a passion of mine. I was a political science major in college, so you're writing papers every semester. And then when I went to law school, they said, hey, if you want to get a really good job, you need to get on the Law Review. How do you get on the Law Review? Well, they have this thing called writing on, where you write a case comment and they accept. There were about 100 people, I think, that tried out, and they accept about 10. Published 4 among those 10, and mine was one of the 4. So I'm like, okay, you know, maybe I can write a little bit. And then if you really want to get ahead in the legal world, you write scholarly articles for other law reviews, other universities. And so I started doing that. So that got me on the writing bent. So as a young lawyer, I started writing articles for like the National Law Journal, the Florida Bar Journal, these different universities and so forth. And I enjoyed it. And so through the years, you know, I transition, and then, and let me just throw this in. If you look at the lineup of the great thriller writers, a lot of them are lawyers. John Grisham was a lawyer. Steve Barry was a lawyer. David Baldacci was a lawyer. Brad Metzer was a lawyer. So it's not uncommon that lawyers sort of shift over to this, because it's a lot more fun than practicing law.
Well,
can tell you that.
Well, and it sounds like some of the sort of analytical gifts that come in handy when you are a lawyer come in handy also when you are maybe constructing thrillers or doing research and that sort of thing.
Indeed. More so with the latter. Most lawyers, writing is critical to being a lawyer, and it's critical when you're taking exams as well. So it behooves you when you're in college to learn how to write, and then, of course, when you're in law school, it gets better and so on, and then you're publishing, it gets better. So, I mean, for me, it was several decades, I mean, probably 30 years of training, if you will.
Hmm. Do you happen to recall when exactly and how you came across the name of Aileen Griffith? Was it through the course of researching some of your previous book about other female spies?
That's normally how I find spies, because I'll stumble across them in reading another book about another spy, and then I find this spy mentioned. But this one was not that case. This one, somebody had told me about her and said, hey, there's this woman, Aileen Griffith, she wrote a couple of these books, and I don't know if any of this is true. It sounds pretty wild, sounds pretty unbelievable, but if half of it's true, it'd be a great book. So I started researching, and it turns out Aileen had written a lot of books, but she wrote a nonfiction book was her first one, and a nonfiction book was her last one. The first one was called The History of Pascualet, about a finca that she had renovated in Spain, And she explains in the first chapter why an American girl's in Spain. And she says, I was an OSS agent. And that's completely nonfiction. The end of an epic at the end of her life is completely nonfiction. She wrote a nonfiction article for the National Archives in 93, I believe is when that one came out. And then in between, she wrote, and oh, by the way, and she wrote just a straight novel as well. But in between, she wrote three memoirs about her World War II experience and then after. And those are historical fiction because she makes up a lot. There's a lot in there. But, I mean, to give you an example, through those three books, she mentions nine murders. Well, eight of those she made up. And I know that the ninth one was accurate because I tracked down the person who literally removed the body. The players are all dead. I mean, Helene's dead, and the people she worked with in Madrid are dead. But I found two sons of Robert Dunev, who was Helene's coding partner in Madrid. And they said, hey, look, our father wrote this memoir. It's about 100 pages just for us, just for the family. Would you like to see it? And I said, absolutely. So they sent it to me. And there's a line in there that says, which reminds me of the night that I removed the body from Aileen's apartment. So I knew that one was true. But the others, I know that she had made up. For example, she supposedly has her partner, Edmundo LaSalle, killing and stabbing to death a guy in Casino Estoril. And in the most like cinematic possible version. Well, that was impossible because he wasn't even in the country. He wasn't even on the continent until 6 months later. And so anyway, just to give you an example. So my job was to find out what really happened. What did she really do?
And no small matter, particularly when it comes to somebody who was a spy and doing what she was doing behind a veil of subterfuge and someone who, in a sense, further veiled the truth of what she did by writing all of these thickly fictionalized accounts of it. So you had your work cut out for you in searching through all of that. You had, of course.
Well, that's where the archives come in, because the judge, if you will, the answer is in the archives, the OSS archives, and those are all of the OSS records are held in the at National Archives 2 in College Park, Maryland. And so I had to go there and spend 4 days from open to close pouring through dozens and dozens of boxes of files that they have on everyone that worked in the Madrid office, Aileen and all the people around her, her bosses and the other spies and so forth.
Could you give us a sense of what one finds in those OSS files? You evidently took your time and really exhaustively pored through them. In fact, you tell us in the preface of your book, you examined every word in Aileen's files. Exactly what does one find in those files? And even at a glance, just sort of what do they look like?
Right. Well, in fact, I looked not only at her files, but I looked at the files of everybody around her. Gregory Thomas was her ultimate boss. He ran the Madrid office. He was the OSS station chief in Madrid. And then her two principal bosses, James McMillan and Larry Mellon from the famous Mellon family, those were the guys directly above her that gave her most of her assignments. And then the other spies, as I mentioned, Edmundo LaSalle, Robert Dunev, who were both very close to Aileen and worked a lot with her, as well as the other side. I mean, I had to pull the files on the people Aileen was chasing, the people that she was trying to figure out. Hans Lazar, who was the German press attaché in Madrid at the time. Gloria von Furstenberg, this beautiful, mysterious woman who had come from Germany. She'd been married to a German, was in Madrid, had no ostensible means of support. She had left her husband. And she hobnobbed with all these Germans. I mean, she would show up at parties and restaurants with these German officials. And so we were trying to figure out what side she was on. And then there was a Prince von Max Egon von Hohenlohe, who is a very somewhat famous character in the history of World War II, because he had tried to negotiate on behalf of Germany with Alan Dulles, who was the OSS guy in Switzerland, to resolve the war, first on behalf of Goering and then later on behalf of Himmler. And so the OSS is wondering, you know, is he really a Nazi? Do we need to pay attention to him? So Eileen sent on all these assignments, to, you know, basically to find out about all these people. And so what you find in the reports is, you know, she, and by the way, she turned in 59 reports. That's more than any other agent. While, yes, later in her life, you know, she makes up a lot of the stuff that she did, but she was, make no mistake, she was a very good agent. And if you look at all of the reports that everybody turned in Madrid, not only did she have the most with 59, but probably more than all of the others combined.
Wow.
So she was a very valuable agent and did a great job at what she was tasked to do. So in a report, it might say, I went here, I went to this party, I went to this event, and here's what I saw, here's who I found, and oh, by the way, I think this person is a Nazi collaborator, and oh, by the way, this person I know is a Gestapo agent, and oh, by the way, this person is a war criminal. You know, so it just depends on what person it was and what event she went to, but those are the kind of things she puts in her reports, as well as she starts recruiting her own sub-agents. They let her recruit and supervise her own sub-agents, and she says things like, I've recruited Flamenco, code name, and I think we need to pay her. We need to pay her because this is very dangerous what she's doing. There are a lot of German front companies, and so Eileen or these sub-agents she had would go in there or maybe had already worked there and become essentially like double agents. So anyway, those are the things that you would find in a report.
Hmm. And I'm assuming that in many cases we're talking about files that are not significantly redacted. That is, you're looking at documents that don't have a whole lot of black lines obliterating much of the text. Are these
Correct.
Largely open
Correct.
Files?
And the reason is because originally they were all classified. All of these, and this is true for both sides, I mean, for the British as well as the American side, all of these were classified for decades. So not until the 80s does this door start to open and some of these files become declassified. So originally there was not really much need for an agency to redact anything because it's classified. No one can see it, and no one's going to see it for 40 years. So by the time and the OSS files were held by the CIA, and then the CIA released them to the National Archives. So the files that I actually saw, none of them are redacted. Occasionally, I mean, I can remember in some UK files where there might be a really deep cover agent where they just took the name out or whited the name out. But rarely does that happen. And I did not see that at all in the OSS records. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Larry Loftus, author of The Princess Spy, The True Story of World War II Spy Eileen Griffith. We should talk for a couple of minutes about Eileen Griffith's idyllic background in Pearl River, New York, because if one looks at her background, one would never guess that such exciting affairs are in her future. Tell us a little bit about the kind of community in which she grew up, the kind of childhood she had, and sort of the path that ultimately takes her to New York City and the beginning of this remarkable adventure.
Eileen was a normal person. She was a small-town girl, grew up in a little hamlet outside of New York City called Pearl River. Pearl River is one of those towns that has the one stop sign, the one post office, the one grocery store. She went to the same school, grades 1 through 12. So she's really a small-town girl. When she graduated from college, she didn't know what really she wanted to do because when you're 22 and you have no job skills, you haven't been in the marketplace yet, she really didn't have a lot of things that she was skilled to do yet, and she wanted to get into the war. Her brothers had been in the war. She wanted to get in the war, but she's 22. She's a woman. What's she going to do? So she takes a job as a model. She's very beautiful. She was 5'9 and gorgeous. So she takes a job as a model for Hattie Carnegie, which is at the time was probably the most prestigious modeling agency in New York City. In fact, Lucille Ball had started her career there. So she works there, all the while longing still to do something for the war. And lo and behold, she's invited to a dinner party and she has a blind date. Well, the blind date is this man named Frank Ryan. Well, she has no idea, but Frank Ryan is an OSS guy. In fact, he's in charge of the Iberian Peninsula, so he's recruiting essentially for spies to go into Portugal and Spain. So as they're talking during dinner, he says, "So, do you want to be a famous model?" And she's like, "Oh, heck no, I want to get into the war." And he goes, "Really? Why do you want to get into the war?" "Well, my brothers are in the war, and I want to help. I want to do my part. I want to do something for the war effort, but there's not really much I can do." And he starts interviewing her, essentially, and he says, "Well, do you speak any foreign languages?" And she says, "Well, I'm pretty fluent in French, I'm relatively fluent in Spanish, and I've got a working knowledge of French." Well, his eyes light up because he's in charge of recruiting spies for Spain. Hmm. So he continues to ask her questions, and then they end the evening, and he says, "Well, look, if you hear of a guy named, if you hear from a guy named Mr. Tomlinson, you'll know what it's about. He might be able to find you something to do in the war." Well, she has no idea what that means or who this guy is, this Tomlinson guy, and I'm sure that was an alias anyway. Well, that guy calls her house, you know, a couple weeks later, and they meet. He tells her, "Meet me at the Biltmore Hotel tomorrow at 6 o'clock. So she does, and he essentially recruits her, and they send her to the farm, what's called the farm. It was an OSS training facility just outside of D.C., 100 acres. And so it's a three-week program, very intensive. They shoot all the weapons. She learns how to become an expert with all the pistols, with all the rifles, with all the, you know, even machine guns. She learned how to shoot a Tommy gun. And then she learned how to even to fight with a knife. In fact, she was a female version of James Bond. And I say that because my first book, Into the Lion's Mouth, was about Ian Fleming's inspiration for Bond, Dusko Popov. And the very man that trained Popov how to kill with his hands, how to kill with a knife, and the weapons and all that, is the same guy that trained Aileen, because he was famous. His name was William Fairbairn. In fact, his knife, the Fairbairn Sykes fighting knife, is still used around the world today by special forces. And his specialty, by the way, was the art of the silent kill. So anyway, the U.S., we were behind the U.K., we were behind Great Britain by about 2 years. So they're already experienced, and they already had this training program. So we borrowed him. We borrowed Fairbairn, brought him to the U.S., and lo and behold, he ends up training Aileen. So she was a female version of James Bond.
Hmm.
and so after she's trained, of course, they send her off to Spain.
When you describe this conversation that she has at this dinner party in August of 1943 with this Frank Ryan, it's so interesting the way this discussion is or conversation is recounted. She expresses this intense desire to somehow be part of the war effort as her brothers were on the battlefield. And when he asks her, you know, "Why would you want to?" And she says, "I love adventure. I like taking risks. All the men I know are eager to get over there. Why should it seem strange that a woman wants to also?" And I just find that's a really interesting insight into how she was put together and what was important to her. And what's especially interesting is to think about the utter contrast between the work she's doing as a model for Hattie Carnegie and the work she's about to begin doing for the OSS. I mean, talk about a gigantic leap.
Yeah, in fact, ironically enough, that background helps her tremendously, because as you'll see in the story, for whatever reason, fashion becomes a very significant part of the story, because Aileen is expected to go. She's sent to Spain as a coder. So that means that she's supposed to code and decode information that comes into Spain. Spain is neutral, but Madrid is the hub of espionage. Madrid and Lisbon were the two big hubs of espionage during the war. And so messages would come in from the French resistance, cables coded, of course, that would say, "Look, we found panzers here. We saw German troops here." And Aileen or Robert Dunev would have to decode that to figure out what it says. and then recode it and send it out to wherever it needed to go. It needs to go to the State Department, needs to go to General Patton or Montgomery or to the RAF to bomb whatever they saw. So the job was very important. Well, after she'd been there about a year, they realized she was very talented and sophisticated and beautiful. So they thought, we can send her out as a field agent. So they start sending her out as a field agent at the beginning of 45. And so she is expected to go to these high-level parties with aristocrats, with royalty, with former prime ministers. I mean, that's her new sort of side job. I mean, she has she keeps the coding job, but on the weekends and at nights, she's expected to go to these lavish affairs. And sometimes it's just dinner at a nice restaurant, Horchers restaurant, which I mentioned in the book, and also mentioned in End of the Lion's Mouth, because it was a famous German-owned restaurant that had microphones in the faces to record what people would say. Edelweiss is another German restaurant she would go to. But she would often go to these very lavish parties, like with Prince von Hohenlohe would host a party. And so people are dressed to the nines. I mean, these people are in gowns. You know, the Balenciaga is a famous designer who was Spanish. And so she would have to buy the top Balenciaga for the day. Well, fortunately, she'd already been trained in all that. She'd already been trained in dressing to the nines in these very expensive gowns and dresses, as well as how to interact at cocktail parties and all that. So even though she has this, you know, initial beginning as a model, that comes into play and helps her later in the espionage career.
I also appreciate the fact that when you describe this initial meeting that she ends up having with this mysterious Mr. Tomlinson that Frank Ryan had told her about, you say in the account of this conversation, you know, Mr. Tomlinson calls her, "Can you be free a few minutes tomorrow?" Aline said she could. "Then please be in the Biltmore Hotel lobby at 6 o'clock. A man with a white carnation in his lapel will be looking for you. Don't mention this meeting to anyone." I mean, it sounds like it's straight out of a movie script, except that this is straight out of real life.
Yep. And that's how the OSS recruited people. I mean, secrecy was the utmost importance of the utmost importance, and so they had to mask what they were really doing, who they were, so she doesn't even find out that she's been recruited to be a spy until she's at the farm in training as a spy.
Mm. By the way, we have already tossed around the term OSS, which stands for the Office of Strategic Services. I think it would be helpful for our listeners at this point to understand exactly what kind of an organization the OSS was, the kind of work in which they were engaged, and maybe also clarify what connection, if any, the OSS would have with, for instance, something like the CIA, with which we are much more acquainted.
Sure. When the war starts, the U.S. has no espionage agency. There is no CIA. It hasn't started yet. So we formed this organization called the OSS. They tapped General William Donovan, who happened to be a very good lawyer. In fact, his law firm, Donovan Leisure, is one of the most prominent law firms to this day. So he's tapped to run it, and then he starts recruiting people. So that's our spy agency. That's our spy agency through the war. And ironically enough, I had in End of the Lion's Mouth, because there's a part in there with Ian Fleming and how Popoff is the inspiration for Bond. Well, the OSS has Fleming involved because the America doesn't have a spy agency, so we need the British to help us to create a spy agency. Well, the director of naval intelligence during World War II for Britain was a man by the name of Admiral John Godfrey. He's the director of naval intelligence, probably the number two guy for intelligence with all of the British military. Well, his assistant was this man named Ian Fleming, one creator of James Bond. So he and Fleming go to the U.S. Admiral Godfrey's going to talk to the president, and Ian Fleming is going to spend time to help create the charter for the OSS. So I cover all of that in my first book, Into the Lion's Mouth, because it's directly related to what happens in the story. But so that's how the OSS is founded. The British helped us because they already had MI6, and so we're trying to mimic MI6. Thus, we create the OSS. And then when the war ends, when the war in Europe ends, Roosevelt has died, so President Truman, who did not like foreign intelligence, did not think we needed foreign intelligence, tells the OSS that they need to close their doors and everybody needs to come home. So that happens in August. People in Madrid had to leave by August 1545. So the CIA isn't created for another 2 years. So there's no OSS, and the CIA doesn't come around until 2 years later. Well, who was the espionage outfit in the interim? And it's very secretive. And the reason it's secretive is because the people that were running the Western Allies intelligence were basically three people. You had Donovan from the American side, the OSS. You had William Stevenson, who was the BSC head, the British Security Coordination, which is MI6 operating in England, operating in the U.S. and Canada. And then you had the SOE. If you remember, my second book, Codename Lease, is about an SOE agent, Special Operations Executive. And that head is Charles Hambrough. Those three heads of espionage said, you know, America does need, in fact, a spy agency. So they secretly form, and I say secretly because it was incorporated in Panama. And I can tell you as a lawyer, as a corporate lawyer, the only reason that you incorporate in Panama is to hide it. Because the headquarters is in New York City. So they want to continue the intelligence work, if you will, and they tap the man they tap to run their organization is one man named Frank Ryan, Aileen's boss. You know, Aileen, the guy that had recruited Aileen, who's in charge of the Iberian Peninsula for the OSS. And so they start tapping OSS people. Well, that entity, that corporation, was called the British American Canadian Corporation, named for, easily enough, the British was Charles Hambrough, SOE, the Canadian was William Donovan, and then the American was Stevenson, and then the American was Donovan. So there's your British American Canadian. Well, they later changed the name, probably because that's too obvious. They changed to World Commerce Corporation. So it's a very mysterious company, and I detail it in the book. They have an ostensible real job of facilitating trade with Europe, but as I point out in the book, none of the people involved had any experience in trade, none of them. So why are they tapping all these espionage people to be involved in the organization? And they recruit – so Frank Ryan, who had recruited Aileen for the OSS, recruits her to work for this agency, which he's now running. Which she does. So she goes from Madrid. He sends her to help open the office in Paris, and then to open an office in Zurich. And then he's about to send her to Zurich. And about that time, she says, "Frank, I love my job. I love you. But I also fell in love during the war with this man named Luis Figueroa, and we want to get married." And so as in the book, as the story goes along with all this espionage, there are different levels of romance. And Aileen had four suitors, by the way, but the last one is Luis Figueroa, who is the Count of who becomes the Count of Roman Owns. At the time, his title, and that's a title, not a name, his title was the Count of Quintanilla, but he becomes the Count of Roman Owns, which is a very famous title, very famous name in Spain still today. And so that's the transition that she has, and eventually she does marry him. So that's the transition from espionage, romance, back to espionage, back to romance, until, you know, the end of the story when she has children and all that.
Hmm. We're speaking with Larry Loftus about his book, The Princess Spy, The True Story of World War II Spy Aileen Griffith. We should mention that your book goes into some detail about that training period at the so-called farm, and then when she is ultimately dispatched with the code name Butch to her assignment in Spain. And you tell us that Aileen's posting in Spain was an extremely important one, since Spain was critical to Allied success in the war. Explain why Spain was such an important place for this kind of work to be done on behalf of the Americans and other allies.
During World War II, there are only four neutral countries: Portugal, Spain, Turkey, and Sweden. That was it. So all of the spies went to one of those four countries. From every country involved in the war sent spies to those four places. And of the four, Portugal and Spain are the most important, Lisbon and Madrid being the two key places where spies went, by far the most important. And of the two, Madrid was the greater because it was larger, it was closer to Spain. The information coming from the French resistance coming over the Pyrenees went first to Madrid, typically, and then Madrid would disperse it from there. But it was very important because the Germans had a huge espionage outfit there. They were ahead of everybody. They were ahead of the British in getting into Spain and getting into Madrid in particular. In fact, Johann Jepsen, who was Popov's case officer during World War II, an Abwehr case officer, a German, he kind of knows that Popov is a double agent. And Jepsen hates the Nazis anyway, so he helps Popov kind of secretly. And he tells him, look, you know, where they would go to Madrid for different things. So he would be in Madrid, and he'd say, look, I need to tell you there are hundreds of German spies here. We have about 400 spies, collaborators, informants. So be careful what you say. It could be a bellman that's a spy. It could be a cashier. It could be anybody. So you have to watch your mouth. Just don't say anything. And as I mentioned, oh, by the way, when we go to Horch's restaurant, definitely don't say anything because there are microphones in the vases. So all of that's the backdrop of Madrid. And in fact, Popov noted when he flew in, and I think Eileen did too, you mean on the tarmac, you see German and British warplanes side by side. It's a neutral country.
Wow. So again, straight out of a movie script. Again, straight out of a movie script. When she first begins work in Madrid, I believe it's as what's called a cipher clerk. Can you go into some detail about the importance of this work and the challenge of this work? At one point saying decoding was not for the faint of heart. Briefly, can you just say a word about the nature of this work and its significance?
Right. So as I mentioned, when information would come in from the French resistance, let's say, it could come from anywhere, but a lot of information came from the French resistance because France is occupied by the Germans. So the information would come in, and then Aileen or Robert Dunever, one of the other coders, would have to decode it to figure out what it said. And then there was a very complicated formula to unscramble it. Has to be hard because we don't want it to be intercepted. So it's a very complicated formula. And then they would have to recode it to send it back out. So they got two jobs, decode and then recode and send it back out to whoever needs to get it. So it was critical information. And she did that. She was on call. She worked every day. I mean, Monday through Friday and then sometimes a little bit on the weekends. But she and Robert were both on call. They would typically alternate nights. Because a message might come in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they're all vital. So that information has to be decoded as soon as it comes in and sent out. Otherwise, you know, maybe too late. 100 people may die because by the time you got to the office and sent it out, this event had already happened. So she's on call at any hour of the night, and Dunev is, and they typically rotate nights. And so that was her sort of quote unquote day job. And then, as I mentioned later, she's recruited to become a field agent, and she goes out on assignment through the city.
Ultimately, of course, the work that she is doing shifts into this other arena in which she is basically looking for Nazi sympathizers, or that seems to be at least a lot of what is going on here. And it is so interesting to think about this work that she is doing, which is unlike what we kind of typically think of spies as kind of lurking around alleys and in dark doorways with their faces shielded and so on. I mean, we think of this kind of secret work in that sort of overtly secret fashion. We don't often think about spies being at fancy parties and gala soirees and so on out and about in public very, very openly. But this is a lot of what Aileen Griffith did. And this, of course, ties us back to some of that work she did earlier as a model, in which she had to be very comfortable in these kind of settings. And this is a lot of the work that she did as a spy. Tell us more about, you know, the nature of what she would be doing at these kind of events.
So they would send her out. In fact, McMillan, one of her main bosses, her principal boss, James McMillan, who was the financial chief for the OSS office, as well as he had his own responsibilities in running the office, he sent her to a huge party held at basically at a castle. I mean, they're called fincas when they're out in the country, but this thing's a castle. It's massive. I mean, it's like the Pentagon. I mean, it's huge. And there was a big party there, and it was going to be a weekend party. And so we knew, the American intelligence knew, that as the war, you know, goes into 44 and then into 45, the Germans realize they're losing the war, and they're going to lose the war. So the Germans, the Nazis, know they have to do a couple of things. They have to get their money out of Germany into a safe place. They have to get their stolen loot, the artwork, and the priceless things that they had confiscated in France and Belgium and other places. They have to get that out. And then a lot of them are war criminals, and they know that if they're caught, they'll be tried and executed. So they have to get out. So you have all these three elements trying to get out. The Germans are trying to get out. Well, the conduit was Spain. So what they would do is they would try to get them over the Pyrenees, and then the Pyrenees Mountains separating France and Spain, and then they would get them to Madrid, and then from Madrid they could put them in a diplomatic car and send them out from there. And so there was this effort, and the money would go the same way. The money would just be transferred into Madrid, and then from Madrid it would go. So the eventual place that they're trying to get all this to is Argentina, and there were other Latin American countries, but Argentina was the big one. Because Argentina had been pro-Axis throughout the war. So Aileen is tapped to work on a big project called Safe Haven. In fact, she and Edmundo LaSalle, her sort of evening sidekick partner, they are the two people tasked. And the OSS sends Edmundo to London for training on Safe Haven. He comes back, and then the two of them are tasked to go out and get information. So back to von Hohenlohe and his big party, McMillan tells Aileen, go there. We think this guy is getting money from the Germans, and we think he's laundering it. We think he's sending that money to Mexico because he's tied to Mexico. He owns two homes in Mexico. So go to the party, see if there are any Mexicans there. So Aileen does, and she, you know, meets all these people and fills out this big report and says, I didn't find any Mexicans. What I did find is throughout the house, because she would snoop around the house. So she said, around the house, I saw these photos with the prince and Mexican bullfighters. So anyway, so that would just be, that's the kind of thing you would find in a typical report.
Hmm. You mentioned Edmundo LaSalle, and I don't think we've yet talked about what his cover was while he was a spy in Spain. Tell our listeners the affiliation that he had with one of the most famous companies in the world, and what an ideal affiliation and cover this was for him.
Indeed. Spies had to have a cover job. They had to have, in case they were ever questioned, they had to have something else that they ostensibly were doing. Aileen's was, she was a secretary with the American Oil Commission. Of course, that's bogus. She wasn't, but that was her cover. So her partner in crime, if you will, that she's going out with at night, this Edmundo LaSalle character, his cover was as a representative of the Walt Disney Company. So what better card to open doors when you're in Spain than Disney? Because like today, that's your get into anywhere ticket. I mean, Disney was famous. So and people loved movies, and so Disney wanted to start producing films in the Iberian Peninsula, in Portugal and Spain. So he is the representative. Edmundo LaSalle becomes the real representative to represent Disney in those two countries. But it was a labyrinthine setup because, and I detail this in the book, the OSS just wants that to be a cover. the Disney wants him to do actual work. So they are going to pay him, and they do pay him. However, under the radar, under the covers, the OSS secretly reimburses Disney for all of his expenses, all of his salary and expenses. So there are actual contracts. I mean, there are contracts on both sides where Edmundo's has a contract, and then the OSS has to do a contract with Disney. So all of this is completely confidential, classified information for 40 years. But in fact, the man who negotiated this contract and signed the contract was Roy Disney, Walt Disney's brother.
Hmm.
So we're sending a Trojan horse into Madrid disguised as Mickey Mouse, and it worked fabulously.
It's one of the best turns of phrase in the whole book. I love that, and what an interesting story! It really helps us kind of understand the nature of this work and the importance of being able to have sort of access and a means by which to have, in a sense, doors open to you. And this made a tremendous difference. Well, we leave it to our listeners to explore a lot of the specifics in terms of Eileen Griffith and her many and amazing adventures in her life as a spy. One of the things I just want to close with is the fact that as we read this book, once we kind of get into the heart of it, it feels like every single chapter ends with a cliffhanger. The way that we would find in the typical work of fiction that might be a spy thriller, except this is not fiction, this is nonfiction. And I know you have not bent the facts, for your dramatic purpose, and yet you have found a way to make this book read like a thriller with cliffhanger after cliffhanger after cliffhanger. Can you just say a word about how you managed to achieve that?
Sure. That's been my goal for all of my books. I mean, if you read the Popoff book or the book about Odette Sanson, Codename Lise, they're the same. And so it's because I wanted to not only tell a great story about a spy, a war story, if you will, but for me, I like thriller novels. I like excitement. I mean, who doesn't like watching an Alfred Hitchcock movie with all the suspense and things? So that has been my goal from day one. The problem is it's very difficult to find somebody where there's a lot of things that happen like that. I mean, you can't just have one cliffhanger in a book and call it a thriller. You have to have a lot. You have to have a lot of – could be a gun, could be a dead body, could be a stolen briefcase, could be anything. But there's got to be a lot of action. And so that rules out most spies and most people that I would have a chance to write about. This one was one of those stories where there's just a lot that happens. Now, I can't make anything up. It's completely nonfiction. There's 60 pages of endnotes at the end if you want to check and make sure that I got all this right. But while I can't make anything up and I can't make up dialogue, what I can do, what I get to do as the author, is I get to decide where chapters end. So I typically end the chapter, with the bomb ticking, if you will. So that's up to me to where to end chapters. And of course I do that very selectively.
Absolutely. Well, it's very, very effective indeed. And of course the whole book is so interesting. And as we've touched on, Eileen Griffith's life is still interesting even after her spy days are over. And you tell the story right up to the very end. The book is again titled The Princess Spy, The True Story of World War II Spy Eileen Griffith, Countess of Romanones. And the book is published by Atria, the author Larry Loftus. Larry Loftus, thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book. And thank you for being part of the morning show today. I'm so glad we had this conversation.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Tomorrow on the morning show, in a little bit of a change from our published schedule, I'm going to be bringing you the interview I'm about to record with baseball writer Galen White, whose newest book is called The Best Little Baseball Town in the World, The Crawley Millers and Minor League Baseball in the 1950s. Thursday it will be Brian Albrecht from Gateway Technical College. paying his monthly visit to the program with a preview of Gateway's upcoming commencement exercises this coming weekend. On Friday, the interviews that were originally scheduled for tomorrow, including best-selling author Jennifer Weiner. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information